Joseph wants the culinary world to talk about racism. The pastry chef and co-owner of five Austin restaurants, including Emmer and Rye, Bristol Joseph was recently named to Food & Wine's Best New Chefs list. On the national podcast, he tells Andy Langer how he is using his status as a high-profile black chef to highlight the systemic inequities of the restaurant business. And A Guide to Living Decadently Without Alcohol. In her new book, The Sober Lush, Austin authors Amanda Iyer Ward and Jardine LeBaire offer a booze-free roadmap to a rich, full lifestyle. Writer Sarah Heppola talks to them about their journeys to sobriety and the rediscoveries they've made along the way. And lastly here, COVID-19 turned one Tyler woman into a citizen watchdog. Delilah Reynoso had already been a local activist before the pandemic, but the threat that COVID-19 poses to vulnerable detainees in jails and prisons has pushed her further into advocacy on their behalf. Maurice Chema, in an article published in partnership with NBC News and the Marshall Project, reports on how Reynoso is tracking the coronavirus case count in a Smith County jail and advocates on behalf of those locked up there. Next up from this issue is from the editor. This is Dan Goodgame's letter to the readers. He's the editor-in-chief, and you can write him back at roar@texasmonthly.com. In this month's column entitled The Anna's in Our Engine Room, in this space, I often introduce a writer, editor, or designer responsible for a particular story in the current issue or fill you in on some exciting new hires we've made. This month, I'd like to tell you about two of our MVPs behind the scenes. Anna Walsh, our managing editor, is the staff we're most responsible for ensuring that our journalism makes its way out of our laptops and into the magazine that you're holding. She directs a planning and logistical process that begins months ahead of each issue's print deadline and cajoles us, me included, to make sure everything gets done on time. It's fortunate for us that Anna is a fan of felines because she spends much of her workday cheerfully herding cats. This past print cycle has been particularly challenging as Anna shepherded not only our regular monthly issue, but also the Willie Nelson special issue that will begin reaching editor readers in August. The double load was tough on our fact-checking and copy-editing staffs, which Anna supervises, and our art department. The number of stories we pushed through is mind-boggling, says Deputy Editor Jeff Salomon, who helped oversee the Willie issue. There's no way I could have kept track of it all without Anna, in her patient and persistent manner, reminding me of what I needed to get done each day. Anna joined us last September from the Washington Post, where she helped copy edit its fast-moving online opinion section. She earlier worked at the weekly Baltimore City Paper as a managing editor and also as the copy editor, the food and drinks editor, and a writer on topics ranging from craft beer to classical music. During our annual Edge of Texas Festival in Dallas last fall, on an afternoon when the rest of us were scarfing tacos in a downtown park, Anna sneaked away to hear a performance of Debussy's La Mer at Dallas Symphony Orchestra. I'd never been to Dallas before and really enjoyed the city, she says. She feels the same affection toward the Hill Country and toward Houston, where, during a visit earlier this year, her boyfriend and now fiancé proposed to her. Getting away from D.C. culture, she says, has been good for me. Anna Azey, our human resources director, grew up in New Jersey and studied nursing at Rutgers, where she won a speaking competition that sent her to Little Rock for a meeting of the National Black Nurses Association. There, she met a group of students from Prairie View A&M University, a historically black institution about 40 miles northwest of Houston. They loved the place so much that I decided to transfer, she says. She's glad she did and has been a Texan ever since. Shortly after graduation, Anna switched careers to work in HR. She joined Texas Monthly in January and plays a leading role in our efforts to make our staff more diverse. Over the past 18 months, Texas Monthly has gone from one journalist of color to seven, including two top editors and two staff writers. That's not nearly enough on a staff of 45, but it's progress, and we intend to build on it. There's more we can do, Anna says, to widen the pool of job candidates we're seeing, including by reaching out to journalists of color who hail from Texas but are now working in other states. Anna's last job was at a large facilities management company in Houston. She said she's enjoying working with colleagues whom she smilingly describes as people who are a lot more creative and passionate about their work. Please note that she did not say anything about herding cats. Next up, we'll head into the state section. This is Traveling Outdoors. It's Parks and Rec by Courtney Bond, and her column this month is entitled Pining for Some Peace of Mind. Why Tyler State Park in Northeast Texas is the ideal escape for these times, or any time. Does lugging your weary psyche deep into the dark woods sound pretty good right now? Do you long to just sit and think beneath the sheltering branches of impossibly tall trees? Occasional foray into nature is a tonic in the best of times, but lately it feels downright critical. When a wild landscape is lit with birds and ribboned with animal presence, it tells us that all manner of living things are well, and it draws us inexplicably into a shared happiness, writes British author and nature activist Jay Griffiths. No, our wild places aren't immune to modern-day problems. They, too, are subject to disasters, natural and otherwise. There's no overestimating how much an addled mind can benefit from spending a little time where the air is fresh and the birds are chirping obliviously, and a six-foot span is easy to come by. A place like Tyler State Park, which my travel buddy Emily and I visited in a carefree July 2019, which I write about now in an uncertain June 2020 for publication in an unpredictable August. A little sidebar here. A modern look, architect Josie Lair abandoned the rustic style that prevailed in many parks in the 30s, instead channeling Frank Lloyd Wright and the Prairie School aesthetic in his design of Tyler State Park, striking minimalist structures, including the bathhouse and boathouse. Text. It's no wonder we humans find solace in the bend-with-the-wind resilience of pine trees, the calm constancy of sturdy retaining walls whose every heavy rock was laid by hand, the tenacity embodied in a painstakingly constructed beaver dam. Our world feels tenuous, as do any vacation plans we might have made back when we were on more solid footing. As I write, our state parks have reopened for day use and limited overnight visits. By the time you read this, we may all be happy campers again, roasting weenies and sleeping under the stars. But if we're not, there's no harm in indulging in a little reminiscing. Just recalling the sounds of summer at Tyler State Park, the gleeful chatter of children frolicking in the water, ferocious bark, bark, bark of 10-pound dogs guarding 10,000-pound RVs, the somnolent croaking of frogs at dusk, brings me some comfort. For a moment, let's just pull a pine curtain closed on our collective heartache and anxiety. When I think of an ideal state park, a sylvan set piece worthy of a Wes Anderson movie, this is it. Out where Post Oak Savannah meets the piney woods, almost exactly halfway between Dallas and Shreveport, Tyler State Park seems to have fulfilled the high hopes set out for it in May 1937, when the Tyler Journal predicted that it was destined to become the major playground in East Texas. Stitched together from land sold to the state by private owners 2 years earlier, it is now a glorious 985.5 acres of hiking trails and well-spaced campsites with a crown jewel of a lake at its heart. Ringed by dense groves of pine and hardwood trees and fringed by feathery marsh, the 64 acres of clear spring-fed water often dotted with colorful floats, gliding kayaks, and small boats whose occupants motor past the wooden diving platform at the posted 5 miles per hour, find a spot to anchor and fish for bass, catfish, and crappie. If that's not picturesque enough for you, ascending from the swimming area is a gently sloping lawn where straw-hatted parents unload mountains of food onto picnic tables and chase their excited kids with sunscreen in hand. At the crest of the hill off to the side is the park's original bathhouse designed by architect Josie Lair. The modern, low-slung structure emerges from the landscape, its trapezoidal-hipped roof lending a mushroom-like feel. As you approach the building from the parking lot, the breezeway between the men's and women's changing areas perfectly frames the Blue Lake, becoming an unassuming yet grand portal. Next door, built in the same style, is the park's store, the Silver Canoe, selling snacks, souvenirs, camping gear, and kid stuff, and offering paddle boats, canoes, and kayaks for rent. Out back is a round, smooth patio that decades ago hosted live bands and dancing couples and now has a lake view tables for enjoying a bag of chips or an ice cream sandwich. Even the park staff seemed straight out of central casting. At one point, about to embark on an afternoon float, Emily and I froze in our flip-flops, tubes and coolers precariously balanced when a khaki-clad, official-looking guy stepped out of his white pickup truck and said, "Y'all weren't planning on swimming, were you?" Seems there had been a dragon sighting in the lake. Of course, we laughed, got in the water. 2005, in painfully prosaic fashion, the 79th legislature commemorated the 70th anniversary of the park with House Concurrent Resolution 18. Among the park's most distinctive features are the hand-hewn rock walls and other structures designed to prevent soil erosion. What the esteemed body was trying to say is that Tyler State Park is yet another brilliant production from the Civilian Conservation Corps, component of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, dreamed up to ease and employ a shaking country mired in an existential crisis of its own. Starting in 1935, CCC Company 2888, working under the direction of landscape architect Ben K. Chambers, took land that had been decimated by agriculture and timber harvesting, and set about bringing it back to life, building dams and terraces to stave off further erosion, and planting 600 acres of native trees and shrubs raised at a nursery on site. Meanwhile, their adventures and travails were dutifully and succinctly documented by local newspapers. Hold three men for liquor at CC's seed camp. Group reported to have had bootleg whiskey at Sand Flat Camp. That was from the Tyler Morning Telegraph, November 3rd, 1935. CCC boys go for tap and ballroom dancing, dramas, and public speaking at Tyler State Park Camp. That was from the Tyler Courier-Times Telegraph from July 16, 1939. And CCC open house attracts 8,000 visitors to Tyler State Park on Sunday. That's from the Tyler Morning Telegraph, April 8, 1940. Years later, all that meticulous planning and hard work had paid off in a tiny paradise that Roosevelt's tree army would hardly recognize. There are 13 miles of trails, lyrically named, the hiking only Whispering Pines and Lakeshore, and less so the A, B, C, D, and E, Z loops, which also allow biking. At 2.1 miles, Lakeshore is a lovely, mostly shady stroll, ending or beginning, depending on where you start, at a petite birdwatching peninsula and children's playground. To the tune of cicada song, Emily and I meander down the pass, stopping to study secluded pockets of still water, carpeted with yellow water lilies, and marvel at a huge toppled tree, its massive root system and branching out above our heads like a giant bronze sculpture. At various intervals along the trail are log benches where one can rest and contemplate the water and reflect on how shocked everyone must have been when, in 1963, a 100-foot section of dam broke and released all of it. WBAP-TV in Fort Worth reported tales of tree-climbing downstream farmers and bewildered resident game fish, nearly all of which apparently survived the dam break and now are merrily swimming down the Sabine River. Whispering Pines Trail is a short and easy one, just a mile, but the ground it traverses is a microcosm of the bottomland hardwood and pine forest that characterizes the surrounding area. Enveloped in lush, almost jungle-like greenery, we trod a path of pine needles and crackly leaves through muckernut hickories, eastern red cedars, flowering dogwood, and lots of skinny loblolly and shortleaf pines standing upright, lying on the ground, or hovering in between, caught mid-fall in the arms of their neighbors. A brief interruption in the reassuring cycle of perpetual renewal on display all over the park. A pileated woodpecker searches a decaying log for beetle larvae. A fat white mushroom sprouts out of a fire-blackened tree stump. Its pearly flesh is enticing as a toasted marshmallow. All through the walk is evidence of the thoughtful landscape design conceived long ago, like concrete steps made to resemble tree stumps. And as an informational sign along the trail puts it, strategically placed rock rapids and falls for aesthetic and musical sound effect. The latter contribute to a watery network of thumbelina-sized creeks and streams visited by tiny frogs, blue-winged butterflies, and jewel-toned dragonflies. Speaking of water, as shady as the park is, the summer heat is fierce, which makes the blue oasis at its center more than just pretty scenery. An early morning kayak trip is sublime, a quiet ride across the sparkling, breeze-ripple water, silver-green fish swimming alongside, and turtles lined up on submerged logs like jets on a runway, letting you get only so close before releasing your grip and rolling sideways into the water. In the evening, you're likely to have the whole thing to yourself as the sun sets behind the trees and casts a rose-gold hue over you and your sparkling domain. In the heat of the day, though, when the clouds are at their whitest and the sky at its bluest, complete immersion is a must, perhaps followed by a long, lazy float atop your inflatable of choice, with nothing to interrupt but the occasional mosquito or excited child hollering from shore, his enthusiasm matched by his volume. We have to see if the big bass are out. They're usually out when the water's calm. You could lie that way all day, or at least until the sun descends and brings with it a surprising melancholy, a wistfulness for the carefree, waterlogged happiness you are still at that very moment enjoying. Would that we could stay that way forever. Our bodies, made up mostly of water, impossibly fragile, rocked by gentle waves and exposed to nothing more threatening than mosquito bites and sunburns, an apocryphal dragon. Little sidebar here entitled Roughing It. Choose a tent over a cabin and don't forget to stop for some barbecue. If your sleeping quarters at Tyler State Park are not of the mobile variety, I would choose a tent over one of its aptly named limited service cabins. It's cute on the outside, said Emily, as we stepped into the concrete floored room, outfitted with a queen bed, a mini fridge, a microwave, a broom, and a table whose 20 coats of varnish plus humidity meant anything placed atop it would remain stuck there forever. After a long night of listening to the incessant drone of the AC unit, we were delighted to escape the shelter of four solid walls for a non-climate-controlled nylon bubble in the Red Oak camping area, a small tree-sheltered lakeside spot as picture-perfect as the rest of the park. All was well until a midnight visit from what seemed to be a pack of Boy Scouts, their headlamps lighting up our tent like Christmas. I woke to find Emily sitting upright, head swiveling furiously, righteously muttering about quiet hours. No merit badges for you. State Park Grocery and Gas Station, right outside the entrance to the park, supplies essential items like gelato, eggs, sandwiches, hot pockets, and fishing worms. A six-minute drive from the park will net you a full meal you don't have to cook at Bodacious Barbecue, where friendly folks load up styrofoam boxes full of brisket, turkey, potato salad, pickles, and those little rounds of longhorn cheddar. Finally, as it is my sworn duty to apprise you of the nearest bastion of air-conditioned and chlorinated luxury, may I also recommend High Hill Farm, a retreat about 30 miles southeast of the park where guests enjoy comfortable bungalows set amid acres of green grass, as well as a fine dining restaurant and a pool. Since we were kind of on the subject, this next section is also from State, and it's food and drink, and it's entitled Barbecue, and it's by Daniel Vaughn, his column this month entitled Just Opened at the Worst Time. Two great new North Texas barbecue spots refuse to be knocked out. After months of planning and setbacks, Brandon Hurtado, known for his barbecue pop-ups, finally opened his first brick-and-mortar location in Arlington's new Urban Union neighborhood earlier this year. On February 22nd, about 200 diners lined up outside Hurtado Barbecue to try his monster beef ribs, tender brisket, and soulful smoked beef cheek barbacoa. Just 3 weeks later, though, he posted a photo on social media of the empty restaurant closed because of the pandemic. 15 miles away in Fort Worth, another new joint, Goldie's Barbecue, was also open for only a few weeks before the statewide shutdown went into effect March 19th. That was very soul-crushing, recalls pitmaster Dylan Taylor, one of the restaurant's five owners. All of them had quit their former jobs last year with the goal of opening in mid-2019, but a lengthy renovation of the building, drawn out for months because of a septic system issue and unclear permitting jurisdiction, pushed their start date into 2020. To get by, they offered barbecue courses and held Sunday pop-ups at nearby Zavala's Barbecue in Grand Prairie. Finally, on February 15th, they held their grand opening and breathed a collective sigh of relief. Otto and Goldie's were both highly anticipated restaurants led by owners who had earned great reputations as pitmasters. Few joints were expected to build on the decades-long barbecue boom in Texas and elevate the growing smoked meat prominence of the Dallas-Fort Worth scene. They may still, neither lacks persistence. That was clear even before the pandemic hit, as they were finding their footing. Goldie's shut down completely on March 20, but reopened on April 11 for curbside service only. The face-masked owner, Taylor, Lane Milne, Jalen Hurd, Nupon Nthanonuse, and Johnny White became glorified car hops, taking orders from drivers through roll-down windows and delivering everything in takeout containers. All those plastic utensils and to-go bags cut into their profit, and then in May they had to pay more for their supply of raw beef. However, they didn't feel the need to raise menu prices. Cooking is great, and we would like to make a decent living for ourselves one day, but we kind of got into this more for the people, Taylor says. Still, even though they could have reopened their dining room, they felt customers could be served more safely in their own vehicles. I hadn't eaten at a barbecue joint in months, my longest such stretch in Texas Monthly's barbecue editor, when I set out for Goldie's in early June. Past the sand and gravel pits, I pulled off a two-lane road into the parking lot. The old building had a bright red paint job, a new screened-in pit room, and a neon sign in the window that proclaimed, "We bake our own bread," which Taylor says they were still doing despite the business slowdown. He was even tweaking the recipe for the joint's pickles. That's some real commitment to quality for items they don't charge extra for, and the same goes for the sauce. Tastes like a mix between the sweet Salt Lake barbecue sauce and one with the mustard tang from City Market in Luling. There are 5 quarts of honey in every 22-quart batch of sauce, and it's got a pleasant zing of vinegar. I'm sure the pitmasters don't want to hear it, but I could have filled up by simply dipping slice after slice of their fluffy white bread into that incredible sauce. Then again, it's free only with an order of barbecue. Kind of wanted to present a very traditional and straightforward Central Texas-esque menu, Taylor explains. Protein options consisted of brisket, spare rib, smoked turkey, and house-made sausage, while the only sides were slaw, potato salad, and pinna beans. Might sound boring considering how experimental many new Texas barbecue spots have become, but I didn't want for anything as I contemplated each bite of the perfect pork ribs. Taylor says the secret, besides the juicy Duroc pork, is a very thin glaze and a layer of Lowry season. There's also some in the brisket rub, along with the salt and pepper. As I ate the spread off the lid of my car trunk, which I'd covered with butcher paper, I couldn't help but smile with each bite. Good to be eating at a barbecue joint again, even if it was in the blazing heat of an unshaded parking lot. A little sidebar here. This is Taco of the Month, Tamarind Dream. Tropical toppings on a sweet tortilla make for real refreshment. The restaurant is Tarasco's Ice Cream. Location is 13,932 Westheimer Road right here in Houston. And the taco is a fruit taco. If the term dessert tacos summon versions of U-shaped waffle shells crammed with ice cream, gummy worms, and cookie crumbles, I have news for you. Those over-the-top treats aren't real tacos. They don't use tortillas. For a proper dessert taco, I recommend a tropical concoction at four-year-old Tarasco's Ice Cream. Our owner Sergio Ruiz wanted to pay homage to the pre-Hispanic roots of his home state of Michoacán by naming his sweets shop after the indigenous Tarascan people. His fruit tacos start with sticky, sugary-coated Morelianas tamarind tortillas from Mexican sweets company La Orquieta Pateleta. The maroon-hued discs are the foundation for fresh chunks of mango, pineapple, and cucumber, as well as julienne jicama and plump Japanese peanuts, drizzled of spicy sour chamoy syrup and a raspberry chipotle sauce, along with a flick of tajin ad heat. Both, but customers seeking a little more can ask for Valentina salsa, Ruiz says. Written by Jose R. Rella. Now, back to our barbecue text. Wasn't any cooler a day later at Hurtado, but they were running their operation differently. The dining room reopened May 1st, the day Governor Abbott eased restrictions. My jaw clenched as I walk in. It was my first time stepping inside a restaurant since the shutdown. Although it had sanitation stations, none of the staff or any of the dozen or more customers in line in front of me were wearing masks. The joint now requires everyone to wear masks, and the staff changes shifts more frequently to prevent overheating, which is why the employees weren't wearing them originally. I placed my order for nearly the entire menu, which is expansive, as quickly as possible. It was a relief to retreat out the side door with my hulking tray of barbecue to find several properly distanced picnic tables. Because of the oppressive heat, they were all empty. I had eaten Hurtado's barbecue last year when he and his fiancée, Hannah Hernandez, operated a Friday and Saturday pop-up from the front yard of their current building. They served their menu, which now features additional Tex-Mex offerings, while waiting to complete the renovations on the historic structure, which date from about 1900. And Hurtado was eager to show off his new smokers. A pair of 1,000-gallon reverse-flow smokers had recently arrived from the welding shop of Arnis Robbins, who owns Evie May's Pit Barbecue in Woolforth. Hurtado had requested a finish that was raw, meaning the reclaimed tanks that made up the smoking chambers had not been painted. Anhydrous ammonia could still be seen on their exteriors. Less than a month before opening the restaurant, Hurtado had to return his brand new toys. The health inspector wouldn't allow a decommissioned tank that had once held fertilizer to be used for cooking equipment. Robbins allowed him to return the barely used smokers. Hurtado reached out to Primitive Pits in Georgia, desperate for a quick turnaround, and a week later the company miraculously overnighted two smokers, which, as with most smokers made from reclaimed tanks, utilized tanks that had previously stored propane. We had 2 weeks to get used to them before our grand opening, Hurtado says. When Hurtado Barbecue officially opened in February, Hurtado thought the big hurdles were mostly behind him, and of course came the shutdown. It could have been worse, though. He already had a pre-order system in place and had learned to be flexible during his pop-up days, so the pivot to takeout was easier than it was for other restaurants. Orders continued coming in, and the layoffs and cut hours that he feared would be imminent weren't necessary. I have employees that gave up everything and quit their regular day jobs to pursue this dream, he says of his co-pitmasters, Manny Zarate and Chris Leffel. They continue filling those smokers and selling out a barbecue. They even hired four new staffers. Then, as meat shortages hit the country, his meat supplier ran out of brisket. I went to like 14 different Kroger's across the Metroplex and was begging them basically to sell me brisket, Hurtado says. He also missed face-to-face interaction. I can't tell you how disheartening it is to put a beautiful tray of barbecue together and just shove it inside a foil takeout pan, he says. Those big, beautiful trays of barbecue were again the norm when I visited. Spiced up half chickens, smoked quail, and ridiculously juicy turkey breast came alongside thick slices of decadent brisket and sweet glazed spare ribs. Taking a bite of the smoked barbacoa tostada was an adventure in flavor combinations and texture variation. The staff fries the tostada to order, then tops it with a layer of beans that had been refried in brisket tallow. Atop the base goes smoked beef cheeks, braised in big red with salsa verde, Valentina hot sauce, tortilla cheese, cilantro, and raw white onions. Otto describes his place as a Tex-Mex-inspired Central Texas barbecue restaurant, and this tostada might be considered the mascot. Hurtado came out to my picnic table during the meal to check on the massive barbecue tray he had just built. We talked about the challenges he had faced, and I asked if he'd ever considered closing, at least temporarily. No, he said. We have to survive. We don't have another choice. It's not just an attitude. The prospect of survival is tenuous for so many other independent restaurateurs, including the folks at Goldie's. We were too early on in the game to give up, Taylor says. Time will tell how many of our beloved restaurants outlive this monumental crisis. Thanks to some great barbecue and to having no other option but optimism, Hurtado Barbecue and Goldie's stand a fighting chance. When the pandemic subsides and barbecue road trips are again a normal weekend activity, these two spots should be a fixture on many itineraries. At that point, I think they'll each deserve another grand opening party. And at a natural spot here to remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight into Sound Radio. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Broadcasting since 1967. We turn next to one of our feature articles. This one is entitled, After the Protests, Changing of the Guard. It's by Christopher Hooks. Historic demonstrations sparked by the death of George Floyd could compel Texas cities and counties to break through chronic obstacles to achieving less violent and less biased policing. The killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers in May and the worldwide protests that followed amplified long-standing questions about violent and biased policing and the larger criminal justice system, including the imprisonment of those convicted of relatively minor crimes. In Texas, Black Lives Matter marches have been held in towns as disparate as Vidor and Alpine, Amarillo, and Brownsville. In the big cities, the protests added urgency to local crises of confidence in law enforcement. Symptoms of the wider problem differed from place to place. Protesters in Austin chanted the name of Mike Ramos, an unarmed man killed by a police officer on January 24th. In Fort Worth, protesters remember Tatiana Jefferson, who was shot and killed inside her home last October by an officer who was standing in her yard. In Houston, a botched no-knock raid that killed two innocent people in January 2019 has been capturing headlines ever since. Most of the largest cities and counties in Texas are firmly under the control of Democrats, and activists there have succeeded in pushing through reforms in other areas central to the criminal justice system through changes in district attorney's offices and in city councils. The change in the culture of police departments and in the laws and contracts that often allow bad cops and their superiors to evade accountability has come very slowly when it has come at all. At the local level, elected officials can be wary of going against police unions, which in Texas, unlike some other states, are allowed to participate in political campaigns by endorsing candidates and donating money. In the Texas legislature, police unions pose a significant threat to any bill that jeopardizes the privileges of law enforcement officers, often including what they see as the right to avoid serious discipline for officers repeatedly cited for bias or unnecessary violence. Does Texas now have the opportunity to break through the deadlock? And what would that look like? To talk about it, we gathered four people with different perspectives on the state's criminal justice system. State Representative James White is a Republican from East Texas who has been a leading voice on criminal justice reform. Brittany K. Barnett is an attorney from Dallas whose Buried Alive project seeks to free those given life without parole under federal drug laws. Tarsha Jackson is a Houston activist who got her start in 2001 when her special needs son, then in fifth grade, kicked a teacher and was arrested and charged with assault of a public servant. She's been working with the nonprofit Texas Organizing Project on criminal justice issues since 2013, and she's now running for Houston City Council. Ron DeLord of Austin is an attorney and former police officer in Beaumont and Mesquite who helped find the combined Law Enforcement Associations of Texas, one of the state's largest police unions. He's traveled the world working with and learning about police departments. Texas Monthly's first question of this question and answer, Texas Monthly's question, polls have shown that a majority of Americans believe that the way policing works need to be substantively changed, even if they're not really sure what they want to happen. I'd like to start by asking, is there low-hanging fruit here? Are there reforms at the level of police departments or state government or cities that could be made right away? Mr. White, that's the Republican politician from East Texas, replies, our local and county governments have a definite and immediate role. Your municipal police departments, those are led by local mayors, police chiefs, and city councils. Out my way, the city council meets at least once a month. Your elected sheriff is obviously elected by the people and responsive to the people. There is a lot of opportunity to get stuff done right now at the city council and with your local sheriff. Brittany Barnett replies, as far as immediate things, banning chokeholds, that's number one. That's not some hard thing to do. I also feel that we've spent a lot of time trying to reform things that should be completely reimagined, completely transformed. I'm almost getting allergic to the word reform because we're just tinkering with a broken system. We need full transformation. We need to completely reimagine what it should look like and reimagine justice. I mean, it's great we're renaming schools and removing statues. That's all cute. But it's not stopping police brutality. It's not stopping black people from entering the criminal justice system. We need the statues torn down, but we have to have more than that. Tarsha Jackson says, we've been pushing since the death of Sandra Bland in 2015 to change Houston's police union contract. Not just the police union contract, but implementing cite and release and ending a debtor's prison. Getting rid of these broken window policies that basically get a lot of black and brown people caught up in the system. There are a lot of great reforms that would reduce the number of people going into the system that could be implemented right now. I was arrested in 1994 in front of my kid's daycare center. I was pulled over for running a stop sign and had a warrant for an unpaid ticket. They would not allow me to go in to let the daycare know that I was being arrested. He just handcuffed me and took me to jail. Then, of course, fast forward to Sandra Bland. She should have never been arrested. So the policies are there. The opportunities are there to put forward smart policy solutions that will decriminalize traffic tickets and fees and fines. Texas Monthly's next question. Ron, is there anything right now in the short term that you think major police departments in Texas would accept in the way of reforms? Ron DeLord replies, I think you'd be surprised by how many things we agree on. All of the criminalization of what I consider civil matters has driven up the incarceration population. It falls disproportionately on the poor. People of color are disproportionately represented among the poor, so they end up with criminal records. I know why we have all the traffic ticket fines. All of these things that we have criminalized, part of that is to make money. It's hidden taxes in the state of Texas. We can stop that, and unions would support it. We didn't just wake up after George Floyd and go, wow, look what we've been doing. No, elected officials, not picking on Representative White, but people way before his time, we've known these things. We've had no political will in this country to deal with the real systemic problems of race and poverty in our society. Texas Monthly says, Representative White, why has it been so hard at the legislature to tackle some of these issues? Mr. White says, well, one thing you learn when you get to the legislature, and I think I knew this a little bit before I was in the legislature because I was a high school government teacher, it is difficult to pass a bill. Roughly 8,000 bills are filed every year, and with some of the language in those bills, it's probably good that it's very difficult because some of the stuff is downright crazy. But we've got this great opportunity now, due to the salience of this issue, to make bigger gains than we've made in the past. Texas Monthly says, do you think that the political power of police unions needs to be curtailed in order for reform to happen? Mr. DeLord replies, well, it's a complicated question. I think our whole political process is upside down. As long as every special interest group known to man can donate money to get access, then our system is broken all the way up and down the line. You want to ban the police from giving money? you can pass a Hatch Act, if we talk about the real things that will make a difference in how the police act and how we use the police in our society, I don't think we're against those things. Where I have the most aggravation is that we want to single out the union for being powerful. Representative White says last session, I believe, I had a House bill that provided some guardrails on conducting arrests on fine-only Class C misdemeanors. I think many people have reported that the police unions tanked that bill. I disagree with that, because if I remember the sequence right, we did eventually sit down with our friends over in Combined Law Enforcement Associations of Texas. We incorporated some of their amendments, and that bill actually passed on the House floor with a solid majority. It was on its way to the Senate until some members decided that they wanted a redo on the bill. So it was not necessarily any police organization or a police union per se that tanked that bill last session. It was really the members derailing that. DeLord says, I don't think someone ought to be arrested for Class C. Sandra Bland was pulled over for failing to signal. She shouldn't even have been stopped. She had never been in a criminal justice system. A lot of people shouldn't be. So let's focus on those things. I do believe that we've reached a tipping point. I think this is the biggest opportunity we're ever going to have in America today to drive these issues and make substantive structural change. Ms. Barnett says, one of the things that I feel really strongly about is that we just don't have adequate national data. That's so important. It's hard to understand the shape of the problem if we don't even have standard measures of what police do or any standard reporting mechanism from it. I've worked with Southern Methodist University's Criminal Justice Reform Center to analyze over 30 years of data as it relates to sentencing at the federal level, but the deeper we dug into the data, the less complete it was. I come from a corporate background. I practice mergers and acquisitions. For us to invest billions of dollars into law enforcement and the criminal justice system and have no data to track the outcomes, looking at it just from a purely business perspective, it makes absolutely no sense. No sense at all. Mr. DeLord says, how can we in 2020 not know how many in-custody deaths we've had? How come in 2020 we don't know how many times an officer fired their gun or shot someone or had a prisoner die? All of that is data that the public ought to know. The police work for the government. They have to understand they're taxpayer-funded and they don't get to decide how they're going to police. They don't. I tell them that. Sometimes they don't want to hear me, but they don't get to decide. Their decisions made by the public through their elected officials. Texas Monthly says, I wanted to ask about mental health because it's a factor in so many police interactions that turn bad. What does reimagining that look like? Does it mean more training for police officers? Does it mean some kind of community service officer goes in unarmed and handles suspects with mental health issues? Well, Mr. White, Representative White says, at some point we're going to have to make a decision in this country to look at mental and behavioral health and as a health issue and treat it as such. In talking to a lot of police officers, they want to focus on folks that are endangering our life and liberty. All right. I believe in President Trump's most recent executive order on criminal justice. He talks about resourcing up and training co-responders such as social workers and other folks to work in the community and address these issues of homelessness and mental illness and behavioral health. Mr. DeLord says, I started as a police officer in 1969. I didn't have a minute's training. I'd never fired a pistol. I went to work for 18 months before they said I had to go to a one-month school. Now, I changed all that in the 80s through the legislature, but we still have only about 600 hours of training. Most countries have a year or two before they give someone a gun and have them go out. Texas, I think, is in pretty good shape training-wise, but still needs substantially more and a different type of training. What do we have? 8 hours on mental health, and then you spend a week at the firing range? Austin does have a mental health training, has about 150 officers specially trained in mental health, but that's not enough. I'll say this, there's a lack of political will to fund social programs needed to help people sleeping on the street, those addicted to drugs, and to address other social ills. We as a country have felt like it's some violation of capitalism to have a social network, but if we had a social network, it would greatly reduce the number of people in prison. Ms. Barnett says, we look at police officers as superheroes that should be serving as mental health workers and social workers. They're asked to de-escalate domestic violence, even mentor the kids on the street. No, I don't think that all those responsibilities should be with the police department. We have to allocate a lot of resources away from law enforcement and toward individuals and organizations that have expertise in each of these areas. If I go to a cardiologist, he can't help me with my back. Jackson says, then that will free up resources to take care of social issues like healthcare and infrastructure. We have to really look at the social needs within our community, divest from the police department, and invest in our communities. That is something that is direly in need right now. Texas Monthly says, Ron, is it possible, that's Ron DeLord, is it possible that lowering police budgets while also lowering the responsibilities that we shoulder on police officers could be good for police? And Mr. DeLord responds, well, of course, but let's separate defunding from utopian beliefs as to how we allocate resources. People have a right to the type of policing they're willing to pay for. But I do think we need an honest discussion about spending. I get aggravated at mayors and city councils when they say they're going to take money from the police, but they're not going to reduce all the non-essential services that they're spending money on. The things they like to dole out in their district without putting money toward mental health and the unemployed and minority youth who don't have jobs or resources. So let's do what's right. Let's do what's essential. If police get less money, I'm okay with that. I will say, and I may be the only person on the police side to say this, the incarcerated, the poor, and the people that are struggling are out of sight, out of mind for most elected officials. There's plenty of people with mental illness, health issues, and drug issues who need our help as a society. So that's what I think we ought to be looking at in its wholeness. Monthly says, the state of Texas has moved to require all police to undergo implicit bias training. I know that there's some skepticism among people about whether it is actually effective. Mr. DeLord answers first, what you're seeing in the paper is really not new. This goes back to the 80s. Now, we all know the training itself is not going to do it. It's in your hiring. It's in your supervision. It's in your dealing with people. We're not opposed to any of those things from the union side. Representative White says, when I was going through my teacher certification, we had to take courses that highlighted our differences, the things that you want to champion with all of the cultures that make up our country. So we do it as educators. We have those opportunities when we're going through our training to reflect how we think about others. I remember when I was still in the Army, the first Gulf War broke out. What happened? They brought all the officers in and started mandating opportunities to learn about different cultures in the Middle East, especially in Iraq. So we should not have a problem learning about one another in the United States. I think any opportunity when we can learn about one another, we need to take advantage of that. Ms. Barnett says, I don't think that the effectiveness of implicit bias training is known at all. I'm skeptical that a few hours of training are going to eliminate a lifetime of bias, whether it's implicit or not. I think that even when we are conscious about our efforts and intentions, the whole crux of implicit bias is the subconscious. So it's not as simple as it looks, but I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. More importantly, we can't just have white men reimagining the process. We have to ensure that we have diversity at the decision-making tables. Firstly, black and brown people, and not just to check off a box and create these diversity committees all of a sudden, but to actually be doing the work and listening to diverse perspectives. We have to have people who've been directly impacted by the criminal justice system. They should have a voice and be the center of any movement surrounding them. That includes police and policing. Jackson says leadership has to come up with a system so that everybody is included. Right now, city officials are telling us that there's some police reforms here in Houston that we know nothing about. If you reform, include the community in the conversation. We have not been part of the call. Ron DeLord here speaks at the last here. I'll tell you one thing you could do tomorrow that would change policing forever. We don't have enough women. In the United States, we have about 13% female, about 87% male officers. Europe, Canada, Australia have more women police. Some Australian states have a goal of hiring 50% women. You want to reduce violence in policing? Just hire more women. They have better problem-solving skills. But we have set up a system that's not designed for women who are going to have children. As a police officer, if you have a baby in Houston or Dallas and you're out of family medical leave, you've got to come back to work or quit. If you quit, you cannot come back. If you go to Australia, you go to Canada, they have tons of laws that protect women. We get women in, and then we set up a system that's not designed for them. It's designed for men. Something's wrong with the system. This conversation has been edited for clarity and link. And next up, back to state. We got style and design. This is another interview. It's a chat. It's an interview with by Ariel Avila, titled Block Party. Holly Thagard, founder of San Antonio's Supergoop, makes sunscreen fun. When former grade school teacher and professional harpist Molly Thagard, now 48, launched a line of sunscreen 13 years ago in San Antonio, sun protection was considered the sleepy category of the skincare world, an afterthought in an industry focused on wrinkle-reducing creams and fountain-of-youth serums. After a friend in her late 20s was diagnosed with melanoma, Thagard was determined to help fight skin cancer. She set out to change sunscreen's reputation by giving hers a playful name, Supergoop, by developing products that weren't heavy or greasy, and by excluding oxybenzone, a common but controversial chemical that may have negative effects on health and the environment, including our dwindling coral reefs. Today, Supergoop, which generated $40 million in revenue in 2018, is one of the buzziest darlings of the beauty and wellness industry, with more than 40 types of SPF-packed moisturizers, mists, and mousses online and at retailers such as Sephora and Nordstrom. Texas Monthly first question, since you started Supergoop, the wellness industry has exploded. Why do you think that is? Holly Thagard answers, we're all looking for ways to take care of our bodies and our minds and to lead a more balanced life. That includes looking at everything from the products that we put on our skin to the food that we ingest to moments of meditation. Having been down this road about 15 years, we've finally broken through to this mindset that applying SPF is just as important as brushing your teeth or even wearing a helmet when you're skiing. It's really just about that little bit of mindset change that leads to a more healthy lifestyle. Texas Monthly's next question. Your line, which often comes in bright yellow and blue packaging, includes everything from Play Body Mousse to a sunscreen for the scalp called Poof Part Powder, as well as makeup. The name Supergoop is certainly fun, but do you think it, as well as your branding, has ever been an obstacle to being taken seriously? Ms. Thagard says, it was very different when we launched at Sephora in 2011. It was a wall of Dr. Brandt, Dr. Dennis Gross, Haricon, MD, just very serious names. It took time for people to fully appreciate us. Again, it goes back to our authentic mission, which is that we have to raise a generation that understands the importance of protecting your skin. And we aren't going to do it by scaring people. You don't inspire change by scaring people or talking about scary things like skin cancer. You have to inspire them. Texas Monthly says, in 2015, you secured $6.5 million in funding, and the next year, you hired a new president and opened a second office in New York City. How have those big changes affected your company? And Ms. Thagard says, it's always been about stopping skin cancer, which is one of the most common types of cancer and yet entirely, primarily preventable. In that regard, we've never been tempted to make decisions that aren't aligned with that mission. In the early years, my family really bootstrapped the brand, and we poured all of our dollars, time, and energy into product development. And it was really in only the last 4 years that we have fully built out a team in both New York and San Antonio. While every year I think we've doubled in revenue, I think that shifting of the mindset of the consumer to think about SPF every single day has really grown in the last 4 years. Texas Monthly's next question. The skincare and wellness industry is sometimes criticized as being inaccessible and elitist with expensive products. Is sending free sunscreen to schools through your ounce-by-ounce program a way to make Supergoop more inclusive? Holly says, having options for everyone from a price perspective is important. We do have some multi-benefit formulas that have more expensive ingredients, so they're a little bit pricier. We definitely make sure that we have products that are easily accessible to every demographic. And with ounce-by-ounce, We believe that sunscreen should be in schools across America because that's where children are in the middle of the day and often in sports after school. It's important to teach our youth these healthy habits at a very young age. We were set to hit about 3,000 classrooms this year, but everything's a little wonky right now because of the pandemic. Texas Monthly's next question. Your New York office has grown to almost 30 employees compared with a dozen staffers in San Antonio. Why is it important to keep your Texas office? Ollie Thagard says, there aren't a lot of brands that are national or global in scale that are based in San Antonio. I think that makes us pretty unique and exciting for our city. We've kept accounting, operations, and of course product development, the heart and soul of what we do, in San Antonio. Keeping those responsibilities in a San Antonio office has helped me remain very close to what's most important to me. Also important to have that presence in New York City because that's where the heart of the beauty industry lives and where we can attract the talent that we need to be a global brand. Texas Monthly's next question, what would you say has been your biggest achievement since you started? Staggard says, the team that we have in place today, without a doubt. We have a 40-person team, and what each of them contributes to making sunscreen cool and making the magic of Supergoop resonate all over the globe is incredible. What I've been most concerned about over these last few months has been the health of my team and keeping everybody mentally in the game with us. Texas Monthly's last question of this interview, which has been edited for clarity and length, is what's next? And Ms. Thagard responds, I think we have helped change the way the world thinks about sunscreen. It's now not an icky, sticky mess you have to put up with when you're at the beach. We had to do that first. Now we should get people wearing it every single day. We still have a long way to go. There's no sign of slowing down. Well, my friends and neighbors, it appears we've run out of material for today, and that brings us to the end of our reading for today.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
Each week, Dale and co-host Cheryl Cummings bring you new recipes and cooking tips, specifically for those who have low vision or no vision on cooking in the dark.
Oil is really hard to measure. I've got some measuring spoons on a ring here, and what I did was I just poured the olive oil in. I kind of held my thumb over the edge of it, and when I felt it kind of start to run over the side, I dumped it and then poured and filled it up again and dumped again.
A few months ago, everybody was trying to be healthy, and there was a ban. You couldn't bring in any candy.
That's usually good for like the first 2 weeks of the new year, you know, and then after that, it's out the window, man.
Yeah.
I've even made this before where I've used 2 packages of the dry ranch dip mix.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when somebody finds out you're blind? They talk louder. We even had a guy one time came up to Candace and I and told us we need to learn sign language because I was blind. I'm like, really?
Wednesdays at 8, Sundays at noon, and Mondays at midnight.
Cooking in the dark.
Cooking in the dark.
On Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 96 and clear. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the upper 70s. Then tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the upper 90s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the upper 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the August issue of Texas Highways, and since it's the first of the month, I'll start out with the editor's note, and it's by Emily Roberts Stone. Y'all means all. A few months ago, our staff received an email from a reader seeking travel advice, a common occurrence for us. A recently retired teacher, she wanted to start dreaming up future trips to take once the state reopened, to see places she'd never been, learn more about the state's rich heritage, and support local businesses anxious for customers. But her note came with a deep concern. I'm really afraid because of the racism I've faced as a black woman in the state. Is it possible for you to publish a guide detailing where people like me can travel in Texas and feel safe, valued, and welcomed? From 1936 to 1964, the National Park Service oversaw the Route 66 Green Book Project, an annual travel guide providing black travelers with options for lodging and dining, and other information on safely traveling during the era of segregation. In 2020, a guide like that seems antiquated and unnecessary, or at least we want it to be. But the truth is, I've received emails from more than a few black readers over the last couple of years, talking about places they visited where they felt unsafe or unwelcome. Their experiences run counter to Texas's reputation for hospitality. There are also encouraging stories of Texas towns that are passionate about ensuring that everyone who visits has an enjoyable and enlightening experience. In Palestine, local tourism leaders continue to focus efforts on highlighting the history of the many cultures that make up East Texas. We have a diverse city, and we want to make sure we're reflecting the community as a whole, explains Mary Rahm, who grew up in Palestine and leads the city's tourism marketing efforts. In the last 15 years, the town has become increasingly diverse, with nearly an equal percentage of white, black, and Hispanic residents. 4 months ago, the city hired a heritage development coordinator to work on various tourism projects and provide an unbiased perspective on the history of Palestine and its residents. Tourism leaders are working with former resident Reggie Brown on refreshing and digitizing a 1997 guide on local black historic sites. Brown, whose father was the second African-American county commissioner in Texas, has also helped establish 9 historical markers in Palestine, along with 28 more throughout the state. My experience has been very inclusive in dealing with the city of Palestine, Brown says. I have felt very welcomed. Similar efforts are underway across Texas, and we'll continue to highlight them in our pages and on TexasHighways.com. Our mission has always been to encourage travel within the state, and implicit in that mission is the ability for everyone to travel safely. Every Texan should have the freedom to explore and discover the great beauty and distinctive character of our state's natural treasures, historic sites, and small towns. And now our next article, We All Live in Uncertain. The Handshake is Alive and Well in This East Texas Town, by Sarah Heppola. Think of Caddo as a maze of lakes within lakes, says John Wynn, proprietor of Caddo Outlet Outback Tours, as the two of us settle into a small go-devil boat roped to a dock in Uncertain, on the border of northern Louisiana. For 2 decades, Wynn has given tours of this lake, named for the Caddo tribe who settled in the area in the late 18th century. and he's had to retrieve a number of people lost in the labyrinth of bayous, ponds, and narrow channels. "Boy, are they glad to see me," he says, tugging his gray beard. I ask what could get them. "Nothing," he says. But floating in the unknown spooks a person. Around 60 species of reptiles live in the swamp, and the night grows noisy with the screech and swish. Gators lurk in these waters. They won't attack, but when the light of the boat shines on them, their marble eyes turn red, like taillights rising from the swamp. The name is what drew me to Uncertain. It sounds like a thick novel or one of those creepy noir films from the Coen brothers, but in the months since COVID-19 began dismantling the life we once knew, it has become a global condition. What will become of us? Who should we be? We are all living in Uncertain now. Of course, the 2018 census placed the town's population a bit lower, at 59. It was a few days before Memorial Day, as Texas continued to creak open its doors after weeks of sheltering in place, and I was looking to escape, but not flee caution. I'd visited Uncertain years ago, and I fell in love with a landscape that was peaceful and otherworldly, with many purported Bigfoot sightings in the area. I remember how I walked under the canopy of tall, thin cypress trees, gesturing as I told them my troubles. And while the trees were indifferent, they were also a bit kind. Spanish moss draping from the trees wafted in the breeze. In French Polynesia, they call Spanish moss Grandpa's beard. But to me, the stuff looked like Ophelia's hair, or the gauzy fabrics Stevie Nicks wore in her gypsy phase. The trees were witchy like that, haunted maidens who never give away their secrets. Nobody knows for certain how Uncertain got its name, which seems exactly right. On a late Thursday morning, I sling my beat-up green suitcase into the trunk of my car and head east from my home in Dallas. 2.5 hours along Interstate 20 and into the piney woods of East Texas. The next 30 minutes take me along state and farm roads where my cell signal starts to disappear. I'm heading into the kind of rural emptiness where you double-check the gas level and rearview mirror. I'm outdoorsy enough to find all of this achingly romantic, but my less generous city friends might call it serial killer country. Uncertain is not on the way to anywhere, says Sheriff Tom McCool of Harrison County in a 2017 documentary titled Uncertain. You've got to either know where you're going or be lost to find it. The evocative film is a portrait of men lost in a more existential way. Stream it on Amazon and Vimeo, though it barely scratches the surface of a town whose mysteries run deep. The fact that Netflix has not greenlighted a narrative series about Uncertain is evidence that even the golden age of television has blind spots, and that I should be hired by Netflix. Uncertain is one of those places where every passing stranger feels like a character. The tiny woman with white hair and bright eyes who shows up on the porch of my cabin, dangling a cigarette to collect money for my stay, cash preferred. The man with the mustache at the small grocery store buying a vial of pickle juice to pour into his beer, a new trend. The middle-aged couple outside a bar and grill called Lighthouse, engaging in a friendly debate about whether a shirt bought at a Guns N' Roses concert should be worn after the concert, or does it lose value? Inside the Lighthouse, it's the first day back in business after lockdown, and things are a bit weird. A handwritten sign outside the door lists rules that include no sitting at the bar and no switching tables. Dancing is discouraged, reads one, sounding more like the Bible Belt laws that inspired the classic 80s movie Footloose than the rules of a town that still allows smoking indoors. The wood-paneled, neon-lit bar is just starting to fill at 6 p.m., and the vibe is jokey but compliant. People squirt hand sanitizer into their palms as they enter. A woman sways near the jukebox, one arm outstretched like she's holding an imaginary partner. This is my social distancing dance, she says. Rules are a tough fit for a part of the state accustomed to being left alone. Wynn told me in advance of my 90-minute boat tour that he only takes cash or check. You know, they aren't taking cash in Dallas at all these days, I told him, and he chuckled, a smoker's laugh. Isn't that something, he said. The world's getting crazy. Out on Caddo Lake, Wynn revs the motor of his go-devil, and we head into the maze, which at nearly 27,000 acres is one of the state's largest lakes. I have a mask in my backpack, but we sit so far apart that the precaution seems moot. Most of the folks around here are seasonal, Wynn tells me as we pass holiday boaters and a woman kayaking with a toy dog in her lap. Wynn is part of the year-round crew. He grew up in Uncertain, born to a mother who left and a father who drank. A happy alcoholic, he says. He taught himself to fish and dropped out of school in 9th grade. Caddo raised me, he says. Caddo fed me. He is something of a swamp creature, a peculiar breed adapted to this remote spot that is not quite Cajun country and not quite Lone Star State, a land lost in time. He navigates the boat through a shallow channel, and we emerge into a part of the lake that is empty, gorgeous, eerily silent. For years, Caddo has been fighting the invasion of an aggressive giant salvinia plant, kept in check with herbicides and weevils, a joint effort of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, scientists, and rock star Don Henley, among others. The waterways are clear today, though it's impossible to know how long Mother Nature can be tamed. Wynn tells me he spent the past few months at home gardening with his wife. They own 9 acres about a mile from the lake. The only part of his job he never liked was the phone ringing constantly, but worse was the phone not ringing at all. A silent phone is scary for a small business owner, but with sanctions continuing to lift across the state, the phone is annoying him again. People are champing at the bit.